The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and KUCI.org on the net. Welcome to Prescriptions for Healing Conflict. I'm Lloyd, I'm the show's engineer, and your host is Mari Frank. Mari's been an attorney mediator for 26 years, and during that time she's resolved thousands of disputes as a neutral conflict healer. She's a member of the Orange County Superior Court Mediation Panel, and she's been a law professor of negotiations and mediation, and presently teaches negotiations right here at UCI. She's the author of Negotiations Breakthroughs and co-author of Stepping Stones to Success and several other books. To listen to previous interviews, see upcoming guests, download podcasts, and learn more, visit www.conflicthealing.com. So, Mari, what's your show about today?
Well, our show today is about peace, and it's also about international conflicts. And I have this wonderful book right in front of me called Elusive Peace: How Modern Diplomatic Strategies Could Better Resolve World Conflicts. And I got a kick out of it because, you know, Kenneth Cloke, who's a friend of ours and was on our show, he wrote a wonderful testimonial for this book that I thought I'd read to you. It is increasingly clear that traditional military and diplomatic methods for resolving global conflicts cannot work. In Elusive Peace, Douglas Noel not only shows us why, with explanations ranging from neuropsychology to philosophy and political analysis, he points us to morally meaningful solutions. This is a compelling, exciting, eye-opening read that will make you think and think again. And this is Ken Cloke, who is the president of the Mediators Beyond Borders and author of Conflict Revolution: Mediating Evil, War, Injustice, and Terrorism. And we've just recently interviewed Ken. So this is such a small world. And I want to tell my audience about this wonderful man that I just recently met. Douglas Noel Esquire is a full-time peacemaker and mediator, specializing in difficult, complex, and intractable conflicts. He's an adjunct professor of law, and he has a master's degree in peacemaking and conflict studies. Doug was a business and commercial trial lawyer for 22 years before he turned to peacemaking, and he is a fellow of the International Academy of Mediators, a fellow of the American College of Civil Trial Mediators. He's on the American Arbitration Association panel of mediators and arbitrators, and was one of the first mediators certified under international standards established by the International Mediation Institute. He's also an author. He is the author of the books Elusive Peace: How Modern Diplomatic Strategies Could Better Resolve World Conflicts, which I have right here in my hands, and I love it. He is co-author of Sex, Politics, and Religion at the Office, also The New Competitive Advantage, and Peacemaking Practicing at the Intersection of Law and Human Conflict. Doug Noel is also an experienced, skilled facilitator and trainer. He is also a Northern California, what they call, super lawyer by the Daily Journal. And also, I found out just when talking to him a few minutes ago that he is the radio host of the Doug Noel Show, which is WSRadio.com. And he interviews people on peacemaking. So thank you so much, Doug, for joining us.
Well, thank you, Mari. It's great to be with you.
Why don't you tell us why you named your book Elusive Peace?
The book title, actually, there's another book called Elusive Peace.
Really?
It's a more academic piece. But the reason that I chose Elusive Peace is because it struck me that international conflict seems so difficult to find. And the international bodies that we think are charged with peacemaking have really done an abysmal job of finding peace. The United Nations, for example, has from 1945 to the present, has only had a 9% success rate in finding peace. The regional organizations like the African Union, the Gulf Cooperative Council, the Arab League, NATO, all of them put together have had less than a 15% success rate at finding peace in the world. And as I started to study this, I began to realize that in most peace situations, when a peace conference is convened, in 90% of the cases, the aftermath is further war and genocide, not peace.
Yes.
And so that's why peace is elusive. How come it's so hard for the international diplomats, special envoys, eminent people, to bring people together who are just as conflicted as we might imagine in obviously difficult and in fairly intractable circumstances and fail? When we know that in our commercial practice and in civil mediation, we have success rates of 85 to 98%
success. Right.
What's going on?
So what is going on?
That's why I wrote the book. What's going on, in my opinion, is that diplomats are diplomats, politicians are politicians, and neither one of those highly intelligent, well-educated groups of people are mediators. They don't have the skill, they don't have the knowledge, and they don't have the aptitude to be peacemakers. We're basically asking an oncologist to go into the trauma center on Friday night and manage an urban trauma center and figure out what to do.
Now, when they teach diplomats, and I don't know if you got into this, I didn't really see it, but, I mean, are they starting now to teach diplomat? I mean, how, do you go to school to become a diplomat? I mean, you go into political science, right? Or what do you take to become a real diplomat? International relations or what?
It used to be that you did what I didn't become a diplomat, but I went to Dartmouth College. And if you were an Ivy League graduate or you were a graduate from one of the top 20 universities in the country and you wanted to go into the Foreign Service as an undergrad, as a student who just graduated from college or university, you would take the Foreign Service exam, and if you passed it, you were accepted into the Foreign Service, and it was kind of on-the-job training. Today, there are several universities, especially in the Washington, D.C. area, that offer both undergraduate and graduate courses in Foreign Service and diplomacy, and they actually do have some specialties in conflict and conflict relations. But the problem is that all they do is learn theory. None of those students actually learn how to mediate.
Oh, my goodness.
Even today, we are churning out young people with undergraduate and graduate degrees in diplomacy and foreign service who may be specializing in conflict resolution but have absolutely no experience, even at community mediation level, on how to take people who are deeply opposed to each other, who hate each other, who do not want to be in the same room with each other, and who, if they had weapons, they would kill each other.
Yeah.
And get them to sit down together and talk, which is what we do as mediators. That's our job.
It's amazing that they are not required to take these classes.
You would think so, but no, it's not. It's not required at all. And not only that, but even if it was required, these are people in their 20s who are not going to be in a position to do any good in the world for another 20 or 30 years.
Right.
We have to look at the people today who are doing the work. They're people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s who are at the peak of their so-called careers, and they're being called in to mediate, and they don't have a clue what they're doing. They don't have a clue. One country is changing. Turkey is changing. But other than Turkey, other countries just are not investing in mediation at all. It's amazing.
It is incredibly amazing. So how is it that you got so interested in international mediation?
As both a practitioner and a scholar of mediation, I'm always curious about everything. And I read a book about the 2000 Camp David talks, and I was appalled at reading that book. I was absolutely appalled at how many rookie mistakes the Clinton administration made in managing that mediation. If you read the book is called Camp David, the Untold Story by Clayton Swisher. And if you read this book, which Swisher does a brilliant job of documenting, he interviewed everybody and just did a brilliant job of putting the story together, as an experienced mediator, you would cringe at the kinds of rookie mistakes that Clinton and Albright and Ross and Tony Lake and all these very bright, hardworking public servants made and blew opportunity after opportunity to bring the Israelis and the Palestinians together to a final deal. And that got me curious. I said, is it this bad everywhere? Are these mediators this inept in every situation? So I started looking at a lot of the major peace conferences that occurred in the last 20 years. And I was looking for good examples of mediation. I didn't find one good example.
Now, you know, I'm thinking like the Harvard Research Project on Negotiation and all the mediation that is there. And they also have international, you know, and foreign service at Harvard. I can't believe that the guys that have been around doing this for years, you know, like Bill Urey and like so many of the others there, have not, and I know that they've mediated. I know that Bill, when he was on my show, talked about a mediation in Iraq. But I can't believe that they are not suggesting kind of this crossing over and kind of having this multidisciplinary approach for these people who want to be diplomats.
See, you're a mediator. You ask the same obvious question I do. I can't believe this. The fact of the matter is that they're completely ignorant about the science and art of mediation. And there's another problem, and that there's a certain level of arrogance. In the diplomatic community, there is a certain level of arrogance that they think they know everything, and that outsiders, even somebody as talented and as experienced as Bill Urey, can't come in and work with them because he's not a diplomat. And so there's this huge arrogance, and coupled with ignorance, is just a recipe for disaster. What was another thing that was really amazing to me is I said, well, the UN, I mean, the United Nations, surely they must have a mediation program. If you go to the UN website, and I spent hours searching the UN website, it has such a minimal, almost non-existent resources on mediation, you can't believe it. And if you wanted to find a UN mediator, you couldn't do it. There are, first of all, they don't have any, and second, they don't have any resources even if they did have some.
Wow.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
It is. For those of our audience who are listening who aren't familiar with the difference between mediation and arbitration, and we've talked about it a little bit on this show, but I think for those who are not really understanding, let's have you explain for them really what you mean by mediator versus arbitrator so that they get the difference if they haven't listened to our show before.
Right. It's what I call the shuns. Mediation, meditation, arbitration, litigation. So, right, so they're all different, but we call them the shuns because you don't want to get the shuns confused. So litigation and arbitration are very simple. It's a way of resolving a conflict by turning the conflict over to a third party and having that third party make a binding decision for the parties in conflict and saying, this is how it's going to be.
Yeah, and it's imposing.
When you go into arbitration or litigation, yeah, you are giving up all your power to resolve the conflict, and you're putting it in the hands of a third party, judge, jury, or arbitrator.
Right.
In mediation, you take all the power to resolve the conflict, and you step into the power circle with your adversaries. The mediator is outside the power circle. The mediator has no power to resolve the conflict. All the mediator is there to do is to manage the process, so that you can have a hard discussion, the hard conversation you need to have with your brother, your sister, your mother, your father, your business partner, your coworker, the person who is suing you, whoever it might be. You can have that hard discussion in a structured way that allows for high productivity and de-escalation of emotion.
Yeah, and the mediator facilitates those negotiations and deflects the conflict so that you can actually problem solve instead of argue.
Very funny. I've been doing this for a long time. When I talk about peacemaking and mediation to people who are not in conflict, they love the idea. But whenever you start talking to people who are in deep conflict, the first thing they want to do is go out and hire the meanest junkyard lawyer they can find. And the idea of peacemaking goes completely out the door. And that's also true in international conflict. When there's a border dispute or a civil war, and you're fighting for your life and your ideology, land for peace goes out the window. What you want to do is annihilate the other side. And
right.
So the idea at that point in time of having to sit across the table and talk to somebody whom you hate, whom you can't even acknowledge as human, and have a mediator helping you do that is something that is very, very difficult to do.
Right.
And that's the challenge. Let me just say also meditation. Meditation is what you do to resolve your inner conflicts.
Exactly. And it helps you to get ready if you're the mediator so that you're centered. You're centered before
you
get into the
meeting. Yourself a little bit.
Yes, yes,
exactly.
Yes. So that you can put your golden shield around you so that
you don't absorb
that conflict. Because as the mediator, you have to be centered and you have to be this center of peace so that you can engender that to the others. That's
maintain a non-anxious presence at all times. Yeah, there are a lot of skills involved in mediation. I mean,
yes.
When I teach mediation, I'm teaching neuropsychology, I'm teaching sociology, we're teaching anthropology, we're teaching cultural anthropology, social psychology, group dynamics, conflict dynamics. I mean, the science is intense. A lot of mediators don't even have that science down, but the highly skilled mediators get themselves educated in the, as you mentioned before, this multidisciplinary arena.
Yeah, you have to wear a lot of hats to be a mediator.
you really have to
wear a lot of hats and be there to be a really good listener as well. So there's a lot of things. You know, I want to get back to when you were talking about the international types of conflict and how it's so difficult. What about the emotional and irrational issues that arise that make diplomacy so hard? What about those?
Well, what we know from neuroscience and neurosocial psychology and neuropsychology is that our whole conception of what human nature is wrong. The Western philosophy is based on a sort of a rationalist, empiricist viewpoint that human beings are rational beings. And the truth of the matter is we're not. We're 98% emotional and 2% rational.
Yes.
And everything we do is imbued with emotion. Sometimes the emotion is low level. Sometimes it's at a very high level. It's excited or it's highly stimulated. But emotion colors everything that we do. And in conflict, as I think anybody can recognize, if you've been in a conflict recently, it's a highly emotional experience.
Yes.
A lot of studies have shown, imaging studies have shown, that when our human brains get highly emotional, the prefrontal cortex shuts down. That's the thinking part of our brain. So when we're either one or the other in high states of conflict. And in high states of conflict, when there's high emotion, we cannot be rational. It is impossible to be rational. And there's just study after study after study that's shown this. So one of the things that we have to do as a mediator is recognize that when we have people in the room who are highly emotional, they're not being irrational, they're just being emotional. And their emotionality is interfering with their ability to make good decisions about what they want to do.
Right.
So our job as a mediator is to de-escalate those emotions, to try to inhibit the emotions to the degree that the prefrontal cortex can kick back on, and they can start thinking again and start applying a little bit of logic to what they're seeing in front of them and trying to overcome their cognitive biases and try to make a good decision. Because all we try to do as mediators is help people make difficult decisions in the face of great uncertainty. That's really what our job is.
Right, right. And, you know, I try to tell people in mediation, you know, you are not angry. You have anger. You have angry feelings. You are not a piece of anger.
Right.
So
right.
That means,
exactly.
You know, so because you are, you know, you have angry feelings about this, and those are totally legitimate, absolutely legitimate. But are you going to let your anger rule you, or are you going to be in charge of your anger and use it to let you know that, yeah, there's a problem here and I need to change it. But now that I'm aware of it, I need to problem solve so that that anger can subside.
And, the kinds of conflicts that I work in, I would say that to somebody and they would be so angry they didn't even hear me.
Yeah. Well.
So then you have to go to a different level and work
right.
at a different level.
Right. And
right.
They need to know that it's okay to be angry. I mean, that's one of the things that we do as mediators is we need to let them know, you know, you have absolutely every right to be angry.
Of course.
And yeah. and most of my clients, you know, they want to be empowered. So, you know, if you're an empowered person, you don't want anything to rule yourself, you know, your higher self, your intellectual self. So that's
absolutely.
Why they can really get into it and go, I am angry and I know it's legitimate. I have these angry feelings. They're legitimate feelings. And now, okay, let's kind of subdue those to some extent so that we can start to do what I call solutioneering. And solutioneering
right.
is when you look for solutions. You know,
right.
if you're angry, you need a solution, right?
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Now, when we talk about mediation, and from your perspective, how does mediation internationally, how is that going to give us hope? What are we going to need to do for this to get real peace? Like whether it's Iraq or Afghanistan or anywhere, you know, Somalia, wherever there's, which is all over the world, how are we going to get that kind of mediation going? How are we going to get that going?
The first thing, that's a really excellent question. And I think that it's the first thing we have to, of course, acknowledge is that issues like Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, China, those are all wrapped, and Iran, they're all wrapped together, are extraordinarily complex problems. Iraq is an extraordinarily complex problem. Libya is now an extraordinarily complex problem. It's costing the U.S. taxpayers $100 million a month. Most people don't know that, but that's what it's costing us. What I finally conclude is that what we really need to do is build up a cadre of international mediators, of both men and women who are culturally appropriate, highly educated, highly experienced, and highly trained. And in the next 5 to 10 years, find these people around the world, train them, and turn them into rock stars.
Yeah.
And so they become sought after as peacemakers and mediators. And there's hope for this. There's the Center for Humanitarian Dialogue in Geneva, the Cairo Mediation Center, the Singapore Mediation Center. There's Patrir in Hungary. I mean, there are mediation centers starting to emerge out of these different parts of the world where there is the possibility that we can start training people in their 40s and 50s who are in the middle of their professional careers to be actual mediators. And that's what it's going to take. Short of that, if we have conflicts today, what we really need are teams of mediators going in and having the support, the financial support, and the long-term staying power to work on some of these conflicts. The problem in international mediation is that everybody, first of all, a lot of people chase the Nobel. Do you know how many mediators have gone into Libya since February?
How many?
About 15. 15 different groups have gone in to mediate. They last for a day and they're out. Because they have no staying power. They're going in thinking I'm going to save the day and win the Nobel. I don't think that's really true, but I mean, tongue in cheek.
Yeah.
But there's no staying power. They don't realize how difficult it is. So we need to build a support structure around this. And the second thing we need to do is we need to get the world, the diplomats, out of this work.
Yeah.
They can be at the negotiating table representing their various interests, but diplomats don't have any business mediating cases. Mediators mediate cases. And mediators ought to be independent of any particular nationality. Of course, they'll come from a nation, but they really have to be sponsored by a regional organization or by the United Nations so they can have some kind of neutrality and impartiality. So I would pick an area like Afghanistan and Pakistan and India. Of course, the key there is India and Pakistan. It's not Pakistan and Afghanistan. It's the India problem that's got to be solved.
Right,
so we need some Indian people and some Punjabs and some Pakistani people and maybe some people out of Kashmir who are mediators to come in and start working on this problem.
You know, I was thinking like for the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, it would be so nice if we could have a Palestinian-Israeli who were really a team mediation. You know what I mean? Where they would go in, two of them, and that they were really so in tuned that they could actually team mediate. So that,
that leads to the next problem, and that is that peace always comes in its own time. And if we look at the Israeli-Palestinian problem, the problem that exists in Israel right now is there is no peace leader. Netanyahu is not a leader of peace. He's a war leader. And he has absolutely no interest in making peace with the Palestinians. And of course, the Palestinians have their own problems. So you could have the best mediators in the world working on that problem. But until you can change the heart and mind of Benjamin Netanyahu and his conservative supporters, you're not going to get anywhere.
Yeah, the leaders really have to support. It has to come from the top down.
They have to want peace. They can have no hope that it's possible, but they have to want it. And right now, the Israeli government doesn't want it, which is why we have this no peace.
Right.
Because there are plenty of opportunities out there. We saw from the WikiLeaks that the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, had made some amazing concessions to get peace, and he was just rejected out of hand by Netanyahu. He doesn't want peace. It's his political base.
Yeah.
You know, once he makes peace, what does he have to talk about? The Israeli economy?
Right. Well, don't they need to really, the mediators need to sit down with the leaders first?
To
sit down with the leaders. And, you know, I believe, and maybe this is just from being a mediator for so many years, that there is always a way. There's always a way to get people to agree, or at least to come to some kind of agreement and get to some understanding and really kind of get over that hump of that anger and that resentment and really get to know each other as human beings. So it just seems to me if
absolutely
you could,
correct.
Yeah.
And not only that, but even in the darkest moments when you think, oh, this whole thing is collapsing around you, if you just have patience, it's amazing how it turns around. I'm working with a family that I love, these family people dearly. They're in deep conflict. And just this morning, one of the family members sent an email apology to all the other family members.
Mm.
Complete, abject apology saying, I feel broken and we're broken and I apologize for everything. I mean, unbelievable.
Yeah.
When I thought, I don't know what's going to happen here. So you just never know what's going to happen. And so as a mediator, you just have to be patient, hold compassion in your heart, and be present for people and let them go through their process.
And set that environment of peace. Set that
Absolutely.
Environment of mutual respect and mutual
Absolutely.
Caring. And when you do that, you know, and I'm sure that you did that with this family, so that by you having that kind of a presence, you really brought out the best in these family members for that person to apologize.
Well, you're right. You try to set things up, but you can't control outcomes. That's the other thing about being a mediator, is you can't force people to peace. All you can do is set the circumstances up, and if people want peace, and I believe that almost everybody wants peace, then it will eventually flow. And all you can, as you say, what you do is set up the circumstances, the environment, so that peace can happen.
Right, right. Well, you know, I can't believe this. We're almost out of time. We got through hardly anything that I wanted to talk about. So, let me just ask you this one question, if you could just kind of answer it quickly. What will the readers take away when they read this wonderful book? What do you want them to take away from? I came away with some good hope and some great ideas. What do you want the reader to come away with after they finish Elusive Peace?
Three things. One, I want them to have hope that it is possible to have world peace. Two, that when they read the headlines, they'll understand exactly what's going on because they'll now understand the dynamics of conflicts. And three, I want people to realize that even though we're talking about international conflicts, it's the same is true in your family. And the same dynamics that occur at the international level occur at the family level, between neighbors, between family members, coworkers. And so the things that I talk about in Elusive Peace are just as applicable to any human interaction where there's conflict.
Yes,
take
absolutely.
Those things, three things away from the book.
Yes, it's wonderful. And why don't you give your website and your website for your radio show, too?
Sure. The book website is elusivepeace.com, elusivepeace.com. The radio show website is thedougknowlshow.com, probably the easiest way to find me, thedougknowlshow.com. And Google me, Doug Knoll, N-O-L-L. And you'll find more about me than you would ever care to know.
Well, Doug, it was just wonderful. And we'll have to have you back again and talk more about this and maybe your next book, too. So thank you so much for joining us. And I hope to meet you soon.
Thank you, Mari.
Okay. Have a great day. You've been listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and KUCI.org on the net. I'm the host of Prescriptions for Healing Conflict. Visit our website at conflicthealing.com, and you can see our upcoming guests. You can look at their books that they've written, see their bios, go to their websites, and you can listen to archived interviews and write us about what's important to you or what you're worried about with concerning the conflict in your life. Thank you for joining us, and join us next Monday at 8:30 a.m. Thanks.
It's about trust.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.